My life spins out of control. Momentum carries me at dizzying speeds to the place of inevitable decision. Nausea threatens to overcome as the dervish in my gut whirls in rhythm to the frenzy of my heartbeat. Disorientation and imbalance rule the day as my world skews its rotation around the sun. I reach for the golden ring to end the ride, but my grasp falls short. The sensation of falling overtakes me. My inner voice whispers, reminds me that strength is my long suit, my inheritance. Ride it out, the voice says, spinning threads of salvation into a parachute of hope. Hitchcock is dead after all. Vertigo by Lisa Lowry. I found it on authorsden.com. The show is going to be called Vertigo. I've got a lot of things to say about the feeling that you are about to fall. You know, I haven't seen the Alfred Hitchcock movie Vertigo in a long, long, long time, but I got the idea from that movie that Vertigo was about fear of heights. But that's not the case. Acrophobia is the fear of heights, and the feeling that you're about to fall is more like really dizziness, and I have a little bit of experience. Hey everybody, welcome to the Mad Money Machine, episode 179. We skipped over summertime, and I told you I wasn't going to do a show unless I had something to say. Well, I really haven't had anything to say all summer, but now I do. I've got a few things I want to get to ya. I want to talk about the permanent portfolio a little bit more, of course. I do have a tool that's pretty cool that I think you're going to want to use. It's a lot of fun. We're going to have a spin at the Guru Roulette Wheel. And I'm going to tell you about vestibular neuronitis, which results in the symptoms of vertigo. Yes, I woke up one morning. Hold on just a second. Unplug the monitor there. Making a lot of buzzing sound. I woke up in July, one Thursday morning, about 12:30, and the room was spinning. Acute vertigo. Stumbled into the bathroom, threw up a couple times. And I laid in bed all day Thursday, all day Friday, with my eyes closed, basically. Laid on the couch all day Saturday, all day Sunday. Stumbled around, have to hold on things to walk, because I felt dizzy. Really dizzy. The room was spinning. I look around and whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. The room is just going by. And so, you know, doing a little bit of Googling for dizziness and vertigo, come across a lot of possibilities. And one of them is vestibular neuronitis, which is, of course, an inflammation of the neurons of the inner ear, the vestibule, which when those nerve cells die, you get this imbalance feeling. You the eyes can't coordinate with your position in the world, and you feel like you're about to fall. That is what my ear doctor suspects that he had. They don't know what causes it, and they don't know how to cure it. They do know that eventually the remaining nerve cells you have will help you compensate for your dizziness. I still have a little bit of it, even after, what is this, almost 2 months now. It's kind of funny how the eyes and the ears work together. You know, I can, if I stare at something and turn my head to the left while continuing to stare at it, I can remain focused on that object with my eyes. But if I stare at something and turn my head to the right, it kind of stutters. Can't really, my eyes won't focus on that object very well. So that's a little bit disconcerting. Getting old is not very much fun. The stupid old bodies. My gosh, when are they going to come up with a mechanical replacement for these things that we can swap out parts a whole lot more easily? Or when are they going to come up with that powder? You know, I've seen, I think on 60 Minutes or somewhere, they have this white powder, which if you have an injured place on your body, they sprinkle that white powder on the injury, and it just grows back new body parts. That's what we need, I think. Well, vertigo is also the feeling that you're about to fall. And vertigo might be a good characteristic of where we are in the economy right now. A lot of people that I have listened to have this feeling, this sensation that we're about to fall. We're on the precipice. We're right on the edge of the cliff. And we are just about to fall over the other edge of this cliff. There are some shows that I watch and listen to, like Adam Curry and John C. Dvorak's No Agenda. I think I've heard every episode of that. I do watch Glenn Beck. You know, a lot of people, Glenn Beck is such a polar figure. It seems like people either hate him or they really love him. There's not much middle ground for the Glenn Beckians. I think the people that really, really hate him because, you know, he started out more or less as a Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity type conservative and was in opposition to Democrats. So obviously Democrats, you know, have this deep-seated hate of Glenn Beck. But if you, in more recent times, though, Glenn Beck has been sort of non-party affiliated. Yeah, maybe still a little conservative, but maybe more conservative in the old-fashioned sense of conservative. Even more, what do they call it, classical liberalism almost. Almost a libertarian in a sense. And he has been talking about what the founders of the country originally intended for the country to be. And so it's been very interesting listening to him. But he certainly has a feeling of vertigo, a feeling that we're about to fall in the economy. Of course, reading LouRockwell.com and listening to the Lou Rockwell podcasts, we have a lot of people that think that the government is leading us over the edge. Other shows like Free Talk Live, The Alex Jones Show, even Freedom Watch with Judge Andrew Napolitano and John Stossel on the Fox Business Network. All of these shows are not positive in their outlook on life at this point. Not just happy talk, you know. Maybe we need more happy talk libertarians. And there's one podcast that I'd like for you to check out. If you didn't like the ones I've mentioned, maybe you'll like this one. Give it a try. It's called the Shrugging Out Podcast. Pete Farrell, is a very no-nonsense, level-headed, rational speaker, and has had a couple of interviews and things on his show, but there are some real gems of shows in his catalog now. I think it's only about 35, 36 episodes that he's done, and it's well worth your time to go listen to the Shrugging Out. What's the Shrugging Out podcast? Well, you know, last summer, I think I told you I finished Ayn Rand's book, Atlas Shrugged. Felt like I was reading a college course there. At times, it wasn't pleasurable, but the ideas in it were pretty good. So there's Atlas Shrugged, and then if you read Survival Blog, you'll hear the term of bugging out. This is for people that think that when we do fall over the edge of the cliff, that you'll need to bug out. You'll need G-O-O-D, get out of Dodge. You'll need to go with your survival. So if you combine Atlas Shrugged, which is the sense of stealing yourself away from the leeches in society, and bugging out, you know, surviving, getting away from centers of disorganization, That's where shrugging out comes in. Now, it's not a survivalist's podcast in that sense. He's really talking about outlook for the economy and why things may not get better. I'm not characterizing it very well. He did. He's had a couple of interviews with the author of the book Starving the Monkeys, which is a book that I have not read yet. But it's a book about how if we continue to give lazy people enough money and things to continue their laziness, that that's not really a good behavior to perpetuate. Of course, I guess maybe there's a question as to whether there's more of them than there are of us. I don't know. But so give that show a chance, Shrugging Out, and see if it can help you with your feeling that you're about to fall. I think with this fear of falling, we've come to realize that, just a few short years ago, the divide in the country was between the Democrats and the Republicans. And you would have talk radio Republicans fighting against Democrats. And what we've come to realize is that that's a false divide in the country. That's the Republicans versus Democrats usually divide on such small issues that in hindsight, they really don't matter as much as the big issue of the enormous issue of progressivism versus libertarianism. You know, those who want the government to do everything for us versus those who want ourselves to do everything for us. And that's all those shows that I have previously mentioned tend to fall on the side of more towards libertarianism. They think the government, like Ronald Reagan said, is the problem. People say government can solve our problems. No, government is the problem. So I think the divide of Democrats versus Republicans is kind of going away, and that's maybe what the rise of the Tea Party is. The Tea Party is kind of not really a party, but sort of a third thing. It's like in two dimensions. You've got Democrats over here on the left. You've got Republicans over here on the right. That's one dimensional along a line. Now the Tea Party is kind of above and in the middle of Democrats and Republicans. On a higher axis, it is different than the political divide between Democrats and Republicans. A Democrat can certainly be welcomed in the Tea Party, although, you know, most people think that Tea Party is just a branch of Republicanism. I think it's more of a, underneath the line between Democrats and Republicans, down at the bottom, you've got big government people in the government, people that work for the government. That's one thing the Shrugging Out podcast mentioned on the most recent show is just total up. All of the people in this country, I'm not talking about the rest of the world, just the United States at this point, think of all of the people that depend in some way on the federal government. Certainly the people that work for the federal government, of which I used to be one, so I can't talk just simply about them, but I can talk as one of them formerly. The people in the federal government are certainly, their lives depend on the federal government. People that used to work for the federal government, like me in some sense, people that work for someone that works for someone for the government, contractors to the federal government. Of course, living here in Northern Virginia, I'm surrounded by contractors to the federal government. In fact, I know a lot of people who their job as a contractor to the federal government, they actually sit in and work as a government member, basically. They run projects for the government. And then there's people that receive handouts from the government to sustain their lives. People certainly on food stamps, people on Social Security, people on Medicare, Medicaid rely on the federal government. And, there's many, many more subsidies. I think on Glenn Beck's show the other day, he was talking to John Stossel, and Stossel had this big, long list of all the industries that are subsidized by the federal government. Well, that thinking falls down underneath of this divide between Democrats and Republicans. It's on the bottom. It's progressivism, more or less. It's big government. It's putting a small amount of people in power over a larger amount of people. And I think we have this natural pendulum swinging then from that bottom to the top notion of individual power, the power to decide for yourself how you want your life to be run, the power to control your own property. If you think about it, do we really own our home and our land? What if you don't pay your taxes for a year or a couple of years? What are they going to do with your land and house? Do you still own it? Probably not. You'll probably receive an escalating amount of force from those who govern you. So, personal property ownership, the libertarians believe that we should just be left alone. Let me do what I will. Let me control my own property. Let me control my own destiny. Leave me alone. Don't steal from me in order to pay somebody else. So my original point about the fear of falling and the divide between Democrats and Republicans is that I think we're in this situation because progressivism doesn't work in the long run. You can't have this big government system with all its inefficiencies running, commanding the economy. It's going to not work. And we're at the point now where we have this fear of falling, and it's justified fear. And we need to think about how we can work for ourselves, how we can support ourselves when the others that would support us don't work anymore. We need to think about our property, thinking about our money. Our money is our property. We try to keep as much of our money as we can. We need to put our money into a machine that continues to work for us no matter what the climate, no matter whether the economy fails. And in that regard, let's talk about the permanent portfolio concept and see how well it's done for us this year. Permanent portfolio is our Mad Money Machine. Originally I named this show Mad Money Machine because I was reviewing Jim Cramer's Mad Money TV show. I thought having him help us pick stocks was the way to invest. And I guess back in 2005, 2006, when this show started, we were in a period of prosperity. And in a period of prosperity, stocks just go up and up and up. In a period of inflation, which I guess in a sense we were in, stocks go up and up and up. The permanent portfolio concept says that we can't predict the future. There are four economic climates: prosperity, inflation, deflation, and recession. And we can't predict the future, so we need to invest equally in all four economic climates to truly protect ourselves. And so the portfolio, permanent portfolio, I think, is like a machine. It's a money machine. And it's a mad money machine. I don't know why it's mad. It's not really mad. It's not angry and it's not crazy. So maybe the Federal Reserve is more of the mad money machine, the money printing machine. But first of all, before I get into the review of the permanent portfolio concept and how they've performed against other lazy portfolios, let me talk about this notion of inflation versus deflation. The classical definition, I guess the definition by that most people think that inflation means is the prices of things you buy have gone up. Most people think, there's inflation. My bread costs more. That's inflation. And what I've come to learn interimly is that more money is what is inflation, and rising prices are the result of more money in the economy. If you listen to Mish, Michael Shedlock over at Global Economic Analysis, I can't get his website name exactly right, but he says that inflation is not just money, but also credit and money. And we can't have inflation going forward in the near term because credit is going down. So we are in a deflationary environment. If you think about his definition of inflation and deflation, he says inflation is the expansion of money and credit. Deflation is the reduction in money and credit. Most people are focusing just on the money part, not on the credit part. Well, credit serves as money in our economy. There's more and more credit to buy things, so prices tend to go up. And if you look at the past credit expansionary cycle, when getting a loan was very easy, that meant credit was easy, credit was going up. Well, the prices of things that you buy with these loans and credit went up. Think about houses and the crazy skyrocketing price of houses in the early 2000s. Stock prices had a big run of inflation in that sense in the early 2000s. And so it was kind of fun to watch Jim Cramer's Mad Money show because, a monkey could throw a dart at a newspaper and pick a stock and it was going to go up in value, up in price, because of inflation in credit markets. But now the credit bubble has popped and it's more difficult to get a loan. It is more difficult for companies to get a loan. It's more difficult for people to get a loan. House prices, as a result, have been falling. Stock prices fell and kind of recovered because maybe because of stimulus money that came in. Maybe because banks needed to invest in stocks. I don't know exactly why, but stocks kind of bounced up and down. Bond prices, on the other hand, have done well in the past couple of years. 2008 was a good year for bonds. 2010 so far has been a good year for bonds. And that bonds are the component that the permanent portfolio uses to save your net worth during times of deflation. Long-term bonds. What's the highest leverage safe bond that you can get? It's a 30-year treasury bond, the 30-year government bond. And that one is going to react the most strongly to lowered interest rates. So the permanent portfolio invests in equal parts of stocks for prosperity, gold for inflation, bonds, long-term 30-year treasuries for deflation, and then for recession, just have some money in cash. My particular twist on Harry Brown's permanent portfolio is that instead of just buying the total basket of U.S. stocks, which turns out to be more like an S&P 500 fund, which is the large cap stocks of the United States, the large cap mixed between growth stocks and value stocks, I tend to think that for prosperity, you want to be a little more risky. You want to leverage the prosperity just a slightly bit more, and you'd like a more of a currency hedge. So I split the stock component between two parts. One is small cap and value. Small cap, value, that's one part, and the other part is emerging markets. So by investing in overseas companies, you leverage against, or you're hedged rather, against the dollar going down. By investing in small cap U.S. companies, you take advantage of their riskier nature, and risk is associated with returns. So I'm thinking, and it's proven true so far this year, that my permanent portfolio has, up to this point, through September the 15th, Showing a year-to-date return of 10.3%. Wow, that's pretty good for just through the ninth month. That's more than 1% a month. 10.3% versus Harry Brown permanent portfolio is a 9.4%. Just about 1% difference there. And then, of course, if you don't want to do it yourself, one good mutual fund that you might want to take a look at is the Permanent Portfolio Fund, PRPFX. And there was a write-up in the Wall Street Journal that our very good columnist, Jason Zweig, wrote. This is dated September 18th. And that was yesterday. His column is The Intelligent Investor. This particular article is entitled, Unlikely Superstar, How a Forgotten Fund Got Hot in a Hurry. He says, imagine going from investing zero to superhero overnight. That's roughly what has happened to Michael Cugino, manager of Permanent Portfolio. After struggling to stay above $50 million in assets for most of its life, the fund shot past $1 billion in 2007, more than doubled to $3.4 billion in 2008, and swelled to $5 billion last year. So far in 2010, $1.9 billion of new money has come piling in to his mutual fund. In August, according to Morningstar, investors added $327 million in 1 month alone, as much in a single month as Permanent Portfolio had managed to accumulate in the entire first 25 years of its existence. Woo! He's out there buying a lot of gold, long-term treasuries, stocks. He also invests in things like Swiss francs and a little bit of silver as well. Well, suddenly the fund's assets surpass $7.6 billion. Jason Zweig asks, why is that? Two words, strong results. In 2008, when the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index lost 37%, Permanent Portfolio lost just 8.4%. And in fact, as a side note here, I'll say that the true Harry Brown Permanent Portfolio lost even less than 8.4%. I think it was down about 3% or something. Well, Jason Zweig continues in the Wall Street Journal. In 2009, the Permanent Portfolio Fund lagged behind the stock market, but still gained 19.1%. And so far this year, the fund is up 6% versus 2.3%. I actually have it calculated as being up 8.8%. So maybe he is looking with just slightly older data. So, and he goes on to talk about the originator of the permanent portfolio being Harry Brown. He called it a permanent portfolio. It's a basket you could hold undisturbed for a lifetime. He believed it was bulletproof and fail-safe, protected against drastic loss no matter what the future held. He says this allocation, now Jason Zweig says this allocation would have lost 1.3% in 2008, estimates William Bernstein of Efficient Frontier Advisors. Well, he just said earlier that the fund in 2008 lost just 8.4%. So I'm not sure. I guess, oh, okay. So I think he's talking about the true Harry Brown permanent portfolio lost just 1.3%. There we go. Instead of the permanent portfolio fund I mentioned earlier, losing 8.4%. Well, Jason Zweig continues, says gold and long-term bonds have been the stars of the last decade. Now, as a side note, at the beginning of this year, I decided I'm going to personally dive into the permanent portfolio. I'm going to hold my nose and buy the out-of-favor assets, long-term bonds. At the beginning of this year, people were saying that there is no question but that interest rates have to go up. That is going to crush long-term bonds. And so I said, well, in order to balance, in order to be equal, I have to buy these stupid long-term bonds. And so I did. I plunged in and I bought. I'm up to finally about 23% of my portfolio is in these 30-year treasuries and the exchange traded fund TLT. Well, thank goodness that I held my nose and dove in, because that is the one investment that has saved my portfolio this year. In fact, if I look at the performance of TLT year to date, it's up 16.1%. Wow. 16.1%. And that's after the past week or so of declines. It had been up 23% at the end of August. The I wrote a posting at the end of August on the returns of all the lazy portfolios. Many of them had not done well through the end of August. In fact, cash, being in the SHY, the short-term treasury fund, had outperformed all but seven of the lazy portfolios, and those seven included three of the permanent portfolios. So being in cash through August was better than being in, say, the Scott Burns Six Ways from Sunday portfolio. Well, since that time, the past couple of weeks, early in September, the stock market has rallied big time, and many of these permanent, many of these lazy portfolios are back into the positive. Take, for example, David Swensen's lazy portfolio is now up 6.5% year to date. The IFA Index Portfolio 100 Bright Red is up 5.5%, according to their website. But the permanent portfolios, mine is up 10.3%, Harry Brown's up 9.4%, and the permanent portfolio fund, once again, up 8.8%. Now, there is an article out at William Bernstein's website, The Efficient Frontier, that talks about Harry Brown and the permanent portfolio. He says it's a good portfolio, but the problem is people who buy into it, they won't stick with it. Well, we will see, Mr. Bernstein. We will just see, won't we? I think the permanent portfolio should be permanent. And I think you're wrong about that. But I think you're right that it is a good portfolio. But even knowing that people cannot predict the future with any great degree of consistency and accuracy, I mean, you know, people can make predictions, and as many predictions as there are, some of them are bound to come true. It's like predicting, you know, which card is going to come up. If you get 5,000 people predicting the next card, someone is going to get it right, but they're not going to consistently get it right. They're not going to get it right card after card after card after card. Well, we still have people that try to predict the markets. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the author of The Black Swan, is quoted in Bloomberg, August 11th, as saying on the bond market, "I'm very pessimistic," he said at the Discovery Invest Leadership Summit in Johannesburg. "By staying in cash or hedging against inflation, you won't regret it in 2 years." Down at the bottom of the article, though, it says, in February of 2010, this is about the time I was getting into, you know, myself, the permanent portfolio, Nassim Nicholas Taleb told a conference in Moscow that every single human being should bet treasury bonds will decline. It's a no-brainer to sell short the debt, he added. Since then, 2- and 10-year notes and 30-year bonds have rallied. Mm-hmm. Let's pull something out of the Mad Money Machine tool crib. I got a hot one for you today. You know, one of the things about the permanent portfolio is you really should never look at it. You should just invest it and turn and go play golf, you know, or read a book. Don't turn on CNBC, for goodness sake. Don't read the Wall Street Journal, other than for maybe the life section or whatever it is. Don't read blogs about the economy. And do I take my own advice? No, I guess other than not watching CNBC, I do look at the portfolio every day, and I do read all the blogs about the economy. And so if you're inclined to look at your portfolio every day, you need this tool. It is the Smart Money Portfolio. What's a good word for it? Portfolio tool, really. It allows you to set up a portfolio of stocks, bonds, mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, and it will monitor the performance of the entire portfolio in real time. I haven't seen any other tool like this anywhere available for free on the web to us schmoes. And so it's a pretty good tool. It's something I've been looking for a long while. It's really got some neat features once you really dig down into it. I've gone in and I set up at the starting at the beginning of the year, I acted in this portfolio as if I had bought into the Paul Boyer permanent portfolio, you know, a quarter in GLD, a quarter in TELT, a quarter in SHY, and a half of a quarter in, or an eighth in a VBR and an eighth in BWO. And so as the stock market ticks along during the day, you get red or green, not just for the individual components, like every other tool does, but for the entire glob of your whole portfolio added all together. And I'm showing that for the Paul Boyer Permanent Portfolio, that through September the 17th, this one is showing a gain of 10.64%. That's a little bit different than the way Yahoo Finance calculates it up. Ah, but that's all right. We won't quibble with a 0.3% discrepancy. So I recommend that you go ahead. You have to sign up for an account with Smart Money. You can actually use your Google or Facebook accounts. You don't have to create a new account with them, although you can do whatever you want. Then you go into the Portfolio tab and set up a portfolio in there. You can set up multiple different portfolios to compare one against the other. There's a graph, which if you hover over the various time frames, you can do year-to-date graphic. You can do a one-day, five-day, three-month, six-month, one-year, five-year, 10-year. Of course, many of these exchange-traded funds don't go back a whole long time. But you can look at a five-year return. And one of the good things to note about the Paul Boyer Permanent Portfolio is that it generally has been going up. And there was a pretty severe blip at the end of 2008, but it came severely back in 2008. And then in early 2009 kind of dipped down. But it looks like an upward slope. And we like upward slopes for our investment, don't we? So I encourage you to check out the Smart Money real-time portfolio tracking tool. And like other tools I've given you, this one is free. The best things in life are free. You can keep it for the birds and bees. Not give me money. That's what I want. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble, and for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time on Mad Men Machine Show 179 is... he's not really an investment professional. Henry David Thoreau. Well, Henry David Thoreau. Do you know Thoreau? Maybe in high school you learned about his book Walden. He was actually born David Henry Thoreau, July 12th, 1817. Lived until May 6th of 1862. So if you add all that up, it was only about 45 years. He was an American. Author, poet, abolitionist, naturalist, tax resister, development critic, surveyor, historian, philosopher, and leading transcendentalist, according to Wikipedia. He's best known for the book I just mentioned, Walden, which is a reflection upon simple living in natural surroundings. He's also known for his essay, Civil Disobedience, an argument for individual resistance to civil government in moral opposition to an unjust state. Thoreau is sometimes cited as an individualist anarchist, though civil disobedience seems to call for improving rather than abolishing government. He says, I ask for, not at once no government, but at once a better government. The direction of this improvement aims at anarchism. He says, that government is best which governs not at all. And when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government which they will have. Well, Harry Brown, in his radio broadcast from May 10th, 2003, had this to say about Henry David Thoreau.
He said a long, long time ago, I came into this world not chiefly to make this a good place to live in, but to live in it, be it good or bad. I really appreciate that statement, and I hope you will take it to heart. It is so easy to feel that you are responsible for what goes on in this country, that you are responsible for what goes on in the world. If you're opposed to the war, it's very easy to feel guilty that you didn't do more to try to stop it before it happened, that you didn't write every congressman, that you didn't call in to every radio show, that you didn't do everything possible that you could have done to stop this. And there's a certain presumptuousness in such an attitude. It's a very easy attitude to slip into, but it is presumptuous. It assumes that if you had devoted 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, over a period of 2 or 3 months, that you actually could have done something to stop that war. And you probably could not have, unless you are someone of such great ideas and such great inspiration that you could come up with a way by which you could single-handedly have saved this country from the ignominy of going over and bombing a country that our government had already disarmed. You have to use some perspective on this. You have to put it in context. You have to realize that you are one person. You don't control the government. You don't control the world. You don't control your own congressman or the mayor of your city. You don't control the school board. You don't control any of those people. But you do, at the same time, have a great deal of control over your own life. There are so many things that you can do where you make a direct influence over the outcome of something. I have, for years and years and years, thought of what I call two kinds of alternatives that are available to you. Two kinds of actions that you can take. One is a direct alternative, one where what you do is going to have a cause and effect bearing on the outcome. You do A and you get B. The other is an indirect alternative, where you have to convince somebody else to do something. And if that person is unconvinced, then it doesn't happen. And that's really what's at stake when you write your congressman, when you protest, when you do all of these things, when you try to persuade your friends, when you try to convert people, and so on. Those are indirect alternatives. Their success depends on what somebody else does. And you can say, well, if I do this right, I'll be successful. No, it's not that simple. You do it right, and you're more likely to be successful. But the people you're talking to, the people you're trying to influence, are not robots. They're not programmed individuals. They're not people that if you just put the right input in, you get the right output from them the way you might with your computer. These are living, breathing human beings just like you. No one else can come to you and figure that if he just pushes the right button with you, he's going to get from you exactly what he wants. No, you will decide. And you will decide in a way that might be different from the way you would have decided yesterday or last year, because you're not the same person exactly you were yesterday or last year. You've grown in the meantime. You've learned things. You're aware of more things now than you were then. And so you may not respond to a given stimulus in the same way you would have last year, and other people are the same way. Now, I'm not suggesting that you don't try to enlighten your friends, that you don't try to show people how much better off we could be in a free society, a libertarian society, a society that respects the Bill of Rights. I'm not saying that you shouldn't do anything. What I am saying, though, is that you should not take on your shoulders the burden of the whole world. You should not feel that you are responsible for the outcome of this, and that if you don't do what you should and you don't do enough of it, that you are shirking your duty. You have only one duty, and that is to live your life in the happiest way possible. Because we think we can be happier if we could change society, we make attempts to do so. But we should never forget that while we're doing that, there are so many things in our own lives that we have direct control over, and if we abdicate that control, then we are throwing our lives away. If we abdicate that control by focusing our attention too far away from home, we abdicate that control, and we are throwing our lives away. You're not going to get another chance at this. I hope you live to be 110 or 120. But those last 20 or 30 years, you're not going to be terribly active. You're not going to be playing racquetball and marching in parades. So my point there is that you should make the most of your life while you can. Don't give up on society, but don't make society your ward that you are responsible for. You're not. Once again, what Henry David Thoreau said was, I came into this world not chiefly to make this a good place to live in, but to live in it, be it good or bad. This is the world you were given. Make the most of it. This is the world we live in.
Yes, Henry David Thoreau also said in his Civil Disobedience Treatise, said, is a democracy such as we know it the last improvement possible in government? Is it not possible to take a step further towards the reorganizing and organizing of the rights of man? There will never be a really free and enlightened state until the state comes to recognize the individual as a higher and independent power from which all its own power and authority are derived, and treats him accordingly. Well, congratulations, Henry David Thoreau. You're the guru on Mad Men Machine Show 179. I want to thank you very much for joining me on Mad Men Machine Show 179 for Sunday, September 19th, 2010. I recognize it's been a long, long time since I did a Mad Money Machine, like I said. Was, kind of taking the summer off. Didn't want to do a show unless I had something to say. And I'm not sure when the next show is going to be, but stay subscribed in iTunes and keep looking. Stay subscribed in twitter.com/madmoneymachine. I do have a Facebook fan page. I'll be posting announcements of those two places when a new show is up. Of course, checking the website and checking your iTunes feeds are ways to go. You can reach me, feedback@madmoneymachine.com. Let's see. Well, how else can you reach me? That was Twitter. That's email. You can see me at Bogleheads 9 in Philadelphia coming in October. It's sold out, but if you happen to already be going to Bogleheads Convention in Philly, I'll see you there. And I'll be reporting back from that convention. I guess I'll get to meet Bill Bernstein and Jack Bogle and some of the other luminaries in the indexing world culture and see what they have to say. I'm trying to sneak in a question about the permanent portfolio if I get the chance and see how those guys are all doing out there. Thanks very much. This is Paul Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes vertigo to make a mad money machine. See you next time.